In the early 1920s, Walt Disney was learning the rudiments of film animation while working for the Kansas City Slide Company. The idea of making drawings move captivated the young artist, and before long, he set out on his own, moving to Hollywood and hiring a small staff of animators. The stage was thus set for the creation of a character Disney hoped would charm children of all ages. But as Paula Sigmund of the Walt Disney Archives explains, the little animal Walt had in mind was not a mouse, but a rabbit.
Walt had come to Hollywood from Kansas City and made a couple of cartoon series, the last of which was the Oswald the Lucky Rabbit series. And when he was in New York trying to get some money from his distributor for an additional season of the Oswald cartoons, he learned to his horror that the distributor was hiring his animators away from him and was planning to make the Oswald cartoons without Walt Disney. And Walt said, "You can't do that. It's my character." And the distributor said, "No, I'm sorry. I have the copyright on the character." So here was poor Walt having to leave New York without anything, without his character Oswald. And so the story he liked to tell was, on that train trip from New York City to Los Angeles is where he came up with the idea for his new cartoon character, the character of Mickey Mouse.
It's hard to say just what inspired the idea for a mouse. Even Paula Sigmund doesn't know for sure.
Walt used to tell the story about his early days at the drawing board in Kansas City when he would watch a family of mice, and one little mouse used to come up and play on his drawing board. Now, we don't know whether this is a true story, because Walt also later said that he was afraid of mice, but he needed a character, and a mouse was a small character, a non-threatening character, and just something sparked in him that he came up with the character of Mickey Mouse.
Well, here we are.
Walt did not create Mickey Mouse single-handedly, according to Disney character illustrator and trivia expert Stacia Martin.
By the time he'd gotten the concept for Mickey all set in his mind, by the time he arrived to Hollywood, his partner, Ub Iwerks, was here. And Ub was an animator extraordinaire and a designer, and so together they came up with something that would be appealing.
Mickey, admits Stacia Martin, bears little resemblance to a mouse.
He doesn't look like a field mouse, per se, but, you know, he looks more like a evolutionary mouse, I guess you could say. He's at the highest end of the evolutionary spectrum, which has not been achieved yet by any other mouse.
For one thing, few mice have evolved to the point where they dress quite as nicely as Mickey, who is usually decked out in white gloves, red trousers, a white shirt, and a black jacket. Also, Mickey is the largest mouse in mouse history, a fact that gave Disney studio animators such as Ward Kimball fits.
When he was in a scene, he was about 4 feet high, and he was supposed to be a mouse. Where the dog was a dog size, and a duck was duck size, but here was his 4-foot mouse, and there was something subliminally in our thinking wrong with that.
Something about the design of Mickey, however, is very appealing.
Disney archivist Paula Sigmund.
He's very circular, and psychologists have studied the design of Mickey Mouse, and they've talked about how circles are very, very appealing and warm and attractive to people. In fact, babies will respond to images of Mickey Mouse where they won't respond to other images.
Every time I'm in the park, I see a 3-month-old baby.
Disney company head Michael Eisner.
For some reason, kids are, I think it's prenatal. They're born with an image of what Mickey Mouse is, so I don't understand it. I don't try to understand it, but it's amazing.
It is amazing how such an expressive character could have such an uncomplicated design.
Actually, he was a simple character.
Disney animator Ward Kimball.
You drew 2 circles, one for his head, one for his pelvic area. And you just connected them, and he had rubber hose arms and legs. And these ears just were always round, no matter what. He turned backwards, sideways, three-quarter. He was always round.
The ears don't fit on like a regular mouse.
Disney animator Ollie Johnston.
They just sit up there. When you turn the head, they stay in the same place. So you had to devise ways of moving that head when you turned the head. A little drop in the head so that the audience wouldn't catch that those ears were remaining in the same place.
Mickey Mouse made his screen debut in 1928. Steamboat Willie was actually the 3rd cartoon to feature Mickey. He had already starred in Plain Crazy and Gallopin' Gaucho. But Walt Disney was unable to sell either film for distribution. And in retrospect, it's clear why.
I want to sing it jazzy. Now get this. Blue sky.
The first talking picture, The Jazz Singer, had just been released. and audiences were no longer sitting still for silent movies. So Disney set Steamboat Willie to a musical soundtrack. On November 18th, Steamboat Willie, the first completely synchronized sound cartoon, premiered at New York City's Colony Theater. According to animator Ward Kimball, Steamboat Willie introduced to the world a most musical mouse.
When Mickey started in 1928 and for almost 6 years, he didn't say a word like he does now. And all of his pictures were musicals. He didn't have to talk. He just kept time. He played instruments. The early days of sound, everybody was bowled over by the fact that he played a xylophone, and the sound came out of the action of hitting the xylophone.
Mickey's early films, explains Disney expert Stacia Martin, established him as a thoroughly modern mouse.
When Mickey started making films, he seized on the current trend. His film Plain Crazy, he was emulating his hero Charles Lindbergh and all of this, and it was kind of this voyage of discovery, the new hero kind of arriving on the horizon.
In the early 1930s, Americans had little to laugh about. The economy had plummeted, forcing many off of their jobs and onto breadlines. Mickey's optimism and enthusiasm were antidotes to the hard times, according to Jack Lindquist of Walt Disney Attractions.
Mickey was one of those symbols during the Depression that I guess really said the little guy can win, no matter how bad things seem, there's a bright side coming up. It's the right thing at the right time.
Mickey really was the first cartoon character to stress personality.
Disney archivist Paula Sigmund.
There were many other cartoon characters prior to Mickey Mouse, but Mickey was the first one who really had sort of a rounded personality, could respond to anything.
They were here, there, everywhere, a whole bunch of them. They came at me from the right, from the left, right, left, left, right.
Yes, yes, go on.
They were coming closer. The fight was on. I swung and missed. I missed and swung. I swung again and again and again. They were right on top of me.
And then?
And then I let them have it.
Mickey was an adventurer, he was a ghostbuster, he piloted a mail plane, he went off into Arabia, into the jungles of Africa, he went everywhere.
It was a dark and stormy night. I was in a strange land. Boy, was I tired. I slept all night under a blanket of beautiful stars. And then day broke.
In the 1930s, Mickey was Hollywood's busiest movie star, appearing in 87 cartoons. Among his best, Paula Sigmund feels, was Through the Mirror, inspired by Lewis Carroll's fantasy novel Through the Looking Glass.
Mickey steps through an almost plastic, transparent mirror and into a wonderland world where telephones come to life and playing cards dance around him, Busby Berkeley style, and Mickey puts on a top hat and dances like Fred Astaire. It's a wonderful performance, and you see Mickey being truly a Hollywood star of the 1930s.
Almost immediately, Mickey Mouse was more than a movie star. In 1930, the first Mickey Mouse book and the first Mickey Mouse toy were sold. Before long, Mickey's name and image could be found on everything from comic strips to calendars, and toothbrushes to t-shirts. Merchandising Mickey Mouse became important to the Disney company, the product manufacturers, and, adds archivist Paula Sigmund, Mickey's fans.
By having Mickey Mouse dolls and Mickey Mouse watches and Mickey Mouse teacups, people were able to bring Mickey into their homes, and Mickey became a part of their lives, in between their going to see him in theaters.
And of course, Mickey could still be seen in theaters. In 1940, he starred as the Sorcerer's Apprentice in his first feature film, Fantasia. Mickey's segment of the movie was set to composer Paul Dukas' fantasy scherzo about an apprentice magician who tries to cast one of his master's spells. Years later, Mickey would remember the role as his greatest.
Being the Sorcerer's Apprentice was my most magical adventure. And when I saw the Sorcerer's magic powers were in his hat, well, I just had to try it on.
But Mickey Mouse found that there is more to being a sorcerer than wearing the right hat. Yes, he did succeed in bringing some broomsticks to life to fetch pails of water. But Mickey discovered, too late, that he didn't know how to stop the spell. By the time the sorcerer returned to save the day, the castle was half underwater, and Mickey had nearly drowned. Disney archivist Paula Sigmund still marvels at Mickey's work in Fantasia.
Mickey does not speak. It's all done to the Dukas music, but it's a wonderful performance by Mickey, and certainly the theme of the sorcerer has become a representation for the Disney company.
Seven years after Mickey's smashing success in Fantasia, he starred, along with fellow Disney characters Donald Duck and Goofy, in his second feature film.
In 1947, Mickey took the role of Jack and the Beanstalk in the Mickey and the Beanstalk segment of Fun and Fancy Free, where Mickey and Goofy and Donald had to climb the beanstalk and go up and try and save the golden harp, a singing harp, from Willie the Giant, a giant, not terribly mean giant, just not terribly bright.
I can change myself into the darndest things. Go on, give me something, anything.
Anything?
Anything.
Well, can you change into a fly?
A cute, teeny, weeny, itsy, bitsy housefly!
That's it, a housefly.
Ah, you don't want to fly. How about a bunny with long pink ears?
Well, of course, if you can't do a fly, why,
All right, a fly. Why?
Well, well, because.
Okay.
Of course, our heroes did triumph, and they were able to save the golden harp and bring her back to the Happy Valley.
Defending a damsel in distress was nothing new for Mickey. Time and time again, Mickey Mouse has had to save the lovely Minnie Mouse from danger. The two have been sweethearts ever since they met in Steamboat Willie. Many have speculated about the exact nature of their relationship. There have even been rumors that the two were secretly married. But Mickey told me himself that Minnie is not his wife, at least not yet.
Minnie's my best girl.
Is that all there is to it?
Well, she's a woman of the 80s, you know, and she sort of likes her space. So, put it this way. Minnie and I have been, if I may use the word, sweethearts since 1928, And, I wouldn't go out with any other girl, and she told me she wouldn't go out with any other guy, so I guess we're going together, and maybe one day if I get real brave, I might pop the question.
What question is that?
Gosh, if I told you, well, then Minnie'd find out, and forget I ever said anything, okay? We're just real good friends, yeah.
I know you're a very modest mouse, but what is it that Minnie sees in you? I mean, she's been with you for 60 years. She's a pretty good-looking mouse. I mean, she could probably do better.
Aw, are you kidding? Why, who dresses as nattily as I do? Why, I've got a tuxedo and tennis shoes on. I'm nifty. I'm a sporty dresser, and, got a swell personality and these neat white gloves, and I hope she doesn't go out with anybody else. I hope.
I don't think she will. After all, Minnie has stood by her man through thick and thin, literally. You see, over the years, Mickey's thickness and thinness have changed. Like the rest of us, observes Disney archivist Paula Sigmund, Mickey doesn't look the same as he did the year he was born.
In 1928, he was a little more angular, maybe even a little more rat-like. And the earliest Mickey didn't really have eyes that could focus in on anyone. The earliest Mickey, the merchandise items had sort of a pie-cut eye, like an oval with a wedge cut out of them. During the 30s, Mickey had solid black eyes. But the problem with those kinds of eyes is that if the animators wanted to focus Mickey's attention on anything, he had to turn his whole body to look at something, to respond or react to something. And so in 1940, when they were designing Mickey for his first feature appearance in Fantasia, they designed a Mickey with pupils in his eyes. And in 1940 is where the real major design change of Mickey came. And they made him rounder, they made him a little more streamlined, and they gave him those pupils so that he could focus his attention. And Mickey really has remained fairly close to that look in 1940, although in the 50s we began to bring a little rounder look to him, and particularly in the comic strips, and we put him in a suburban setting. Mickey tended to get a little more suburban looking, maybe even develop a bit of a paunch.
Part of the reason Mickey was putting on weight in the late 40s and early 50s was that he wasn't working as hard as he had in his heyday. Mickey, notes Paula Sigmund, had reached the first crisis of his career.
As Mickey's popularity grew and he became kind of a role model for young children, the studio began to get letters of complaint when Mickey would do something a little mischievous, when he'd try to steal a kiss from Minnie and she was a little reluctant.
Hi, Minnie! How about a little...
If Mickey didn't do everything exactly right, the studio got complaints, and Mickey was almost forced into that Boy Scout role, that all-American, that everything Mickey could do would be right, and he became sort of a little Boy Scout mouse, and it was much harder to write funny stories for him than it was, say, for Donald Duck, who had a temper that would explode in an instant. And so Mickey became quieter. Mickey became always the one who would do something right. Mickey was the sensible one.
That's fine for a role model, but as Walt Disney said, what can you do with such a leading man? Another problem Mickey encountered in the 1950s, explains Disney expert Stacia Martin, was the movie's changing economics.
Hand animation is, of course, extremely expensive to produce, and motion picture theaters by the late 50s had really dispensed with the whole double bill sort of thing where you'd go to the film, see a cartoon, a newsreel, and two movies, and that was your entire evening's entertainment. That wasn't happening anymore. There were big roadshow musicals coming in where you'd have one picture that would last 3 hours, or you'd have a single film in a theater that would run for far more showings per day, which would therefore mean more revenue for the theater owners. And so the short cartoon really just kind of got aced out of the market.
But you can't keep a good mouse down. In 1955, Mickey hosted the television premiere of The Mickey Mouse Club. The series ran for 4 years, winning Mickey millions of new fans. Adding to the show's popularity were Mickey's co-stars, the 24 youngsters known as Mouseketeers, and the lively opening song.
Who's the leader of the club that's made for you and me? M-I-C-K-E-Y-M-O-U-S-E.
Each daily edition of the Mickey Mouse Club had a different theme. For example, Monday was Fun with Music Day. Mickey appeared Mondays dressed as a song and dance man. He opened the show by telling the Mouseketeers what was in store for the week.
Hi, Mouseketeers.
Hi, Mickey.
Big doings this week. Adventure, fun, music, cartoons, news. Everybody ready?
Ready.
Then on with the show.
Then Mickey would leave most of the entertaining to the talented young Mouseketeers.
As we continue through the year.
Through the year.
The high spirits would end with the singing of the Mickey Mouse alma mater.
Now it's time to say goodbye to all our company. M-I-C.
See you real soon.
K-E-Y.
Why? Because we like you.
M-O-U.
The relatively new medium of television had enabled Mickey Mouse to enter living rooms all across the United States. And it was on television that Walt Disney revealed a plan that would, among other things, allow Mickey to meet millions of his fans in person.
Mickey and I started out the first time many, many years ago. We've had a lot of our dreams come true. Now we want you to share with us our latest and greatest dream. Disneyland.
In 1955, Disneyland, the most amazing amusement park the world had ever seen, opened in Anaheim, California. Host Mickey Mouse welcomed children from all over the world to meet him and enjoy the so-called happiest place on Earth. Disneyland's Executive Vice President Ron Dominguez says the park brought Mickey closer to his public than ever before.
That was the first time that you could really touch and live and feel Mickey. That aspect has added to the popularity, the stardom, the life of the character.
When similar Disney theme parks opened in Orlando, Florida in 1971 and Tokyo, Japan in 1983, Mickey's schedule became busier still as he traveled to all three parks to meet as many visitors as he could. But somehow, Mickey found time to return to the silver screen. Mickey made his movie comeback in the 1983 adaptation of the Charles Dickens story, A Christmas Carol. Mickey's Christmas Carol starred Mickey Mouse as Bob Cratchit, the overworked and underpaid employee of the miserly Uncle Scrooge, played by Disney character Scrooge McDuck. Mickey's Christmas Carol, notes Disney spokeswoman Stacia Martin, showed yet another side of the versatile mouse.
He wasn't so much the Mickey of, like, say, the 30s, certainly, the bouncy Mickey, nor was he the Mickey of the 50s when we had last seen him in the context of an animated short subject. Mickey's Christmas Carol was presented more as a repertory play with the Disney characters taking on the established role of the Dickens story. Mickey portrayed Bob Cratchit. It wasn't necessarily Mickey. It was Bob Cratchit as interpreted by the actor M. Mouse, or Donald Duck as Uncle Scrooge's nephew Fred. Scrooge McDuck didn't have to reach too far for his portrayal, you know, greed goes with greed. But it was really, in Mickey's case, an actor in a role.
Good morning, Mr. Scrooge.
Cratchit, what are you doing with that piece of coal?
I was just trying to thaw out the ink.
Bah! You used a piece last week. Now, get on with your work, Cratchit.
Speaking of work, Mr. Scrooge, tomorrow is Christmas, and I was wondering if I could have half a day off.
Christmas, eh? Well, I suppose so. But I'll dock you half a day's pay. Now, let's see. I pay you 2 shillings a day.
Two shillings and a halfpenny, sir.
Oh, yes. I gave you that raise 3 years ago.
Yes, sir, when I started doing your laundry.
All right, Cratchit. Get busy while I go over my books. Oh, and here. Here's another bundle of shirts for you.
Yes, sir.
Mickey Mouse has become a world celebrity. From Italy, where children call him Topolino, to Spain, where he's El Raton Mickey, to China, where he's known as Milao. And as Michael Eisner, the head of the Walt Disney Company, can attest, Mickey is known in China.
My most special memory is being on the Great Wall of China with Mickey Mouse, who hadn't been kind of legally in China since the 30s. And we went to the Great Wall, and he was almost stampeded. There were so many people that wanted to touch Mickey and be with Mickey that it was amazing to me of the popularity of a character who hadn't even been there for so long.
Today, Mickey is a star in just about every medium of entertainment, from the small TV screen to the giant silver screen, from the pages of comic books to the streets of Disneyland and Disney World in the United States, Tokyo Disneyland in Japan, and in 1992, Euro Disneyland in France. Mickey has never been one to brag about his success. choosing instead to express his affection for the man who first sketched him on that cross-country train ride in 1928, Walt Disney. Late in his career, Disney told a national television audience that he felt pretty much the same way about Mickey.
During the last few years, we've ventured into a lot of different fields, and we've had the opportunity to meet and work with a lot of wonderful people. I only hope that we never lose sight of one thing, that it was all started by a mouse.
You've been listening to A Mouse for All Seasons, a portrait in sound of Mickey Mouse. Gary Spiesler was the audio engineer for this program, and Larry West was the assistant director. I'm your host, Ken Bader, for another broadcast from Studio One.